Part 23, Chapter 6. Deep in the African mine site, bent over the view screens in the half-lit dark, Johnny was taking a loss. Day 92 was coming up on them like a whirlwind. At first, he had hoped that he could get a separate console built using Turl's plans and install it down at Kariba. Such would bypass any real necessity for a hopeless attack in America to seize that one. It looked as if it remained their best chance, but it was hardly any chance at all. He would have had to stop Turl from using that strange bomb, but he could not do that without the almost foolhardy risks of letting it go right on up to firing time on day 92 and trying to attack the platform and grab that console at the last moment. Other news was not good. There had been two more raids by the visitors in different places, and casualties had been suffered. An ore plane, returning empty from a ferrying trip, had been swooped down upon by the Hovens and blasted out of the sky with the loss of both pilot and co-pilot. A hunting party from the Russian base had been gunned from above, and three Siberians and a Sherpa had been killed before their air cover had shot down the intruder. Also, the Edinburgh defense planning had gone wrong. Sir Robert had wanted to bring in a couple of miles of atmosphere cable and surround Castle Rock with it. The power dams in Scotland of long ago were not in shape or converted to cyclo power. The Cornwall mine site power supply was a tidal dam at Bristol in the Bristol Channel. And while it worked well on the ebb and flow of those gigantic tides, it was not possible to run a line clear up to Edinburgh. And that line would have been open to attack in any case. The hauling of that much cable itself was a formidable block, for it would have had to be flown in sections to Scotland. No other means than anti-aircraft fire was available to protect Edinburgh, and the Scots, having regained it, were not going to abandon it. It was the center of the most ancient Scottish nationalism. Moving the whole remaining population down to Cornwall, as proposed by Johnny, had not been approved, and it was true it would be pretty crowded. Johnny knew Edinburgh was going to catch it. Turl was going about his job in a way that seemed backward. He spent a lot of time measuring up poles and stringing outside wire and putting in firing points. Everything he did was being duplicated exactly down at Kariba. They now had the wires up and all the points in down at that base. Angus, each time they got a new item, would go tearing down to Kariba and install an equivalent in the secondary defense platform there. It had looked very hopeful for some days. Turl had gotten a lot of metal and had built the console case, a heavy, massive thing about a yard square. They had built the same case here, and it was sitting down in a locked room, an empty shell, waiting. But after all this spurt of energy, Turl, for the last several days, had just been fooling with fuses. He wasn't getting on with construction. Reams of mathematics had been worked out by Turl, but a lot of good they were. Who understood them? Now it was just fuses. Johnny had gotten duplicates out of supply here of all the fuses Turl was working with and tried to figure out what he was doing. Johnny had learned one thing, that some of the items in a console that would appear to be different components were fakes. They were not resistors or capacitors. They were actually fuses made up to look like other things. Turl was doing something Johnny had not heard of before. With meters and such, he was working with an underload type of fuse. The circuit would be connected only so long as current was going through it. When the current ceased to flow, the fuse burned out. It was an odd kind of circuit breaker, made of a filament so tiny and thin it had to be worked under a magnifying scope. Well, that seemed to be all Turl was doing. Johnny's attention was drifting when he suddenly realized that the filament Turl was using looked awfully like the ones in the silver capsule in Cyclo heads. Forgotten was his stiff neck. He went tearing out and got one they had removed from a corpse. Yes, the same thing. Abruptly, he added it all up and rushed out to find McKendrick. The doctor was working with a cyclo's skull he had cleaned and whitened. He was trying to find some means of entering it with instruments. He put it down on the table before him, where the sockets stared sightlessly at him, and composed himself to listen to Johnny.
"That isn't anything very mysterious,"
said Johnny, pointing excitedly into the silver capsule he held.
"It's just a fuse. It doesn't vibrate or put out radio signals or anything. It's just a fuse."
Johnny grabbed some pictures of one inside a cyclo brain.
"Look, you said the nerves this was fastened between were the primary impulse channels of their thought. All right, mathematics is logical thought. It is the approximation of being sensible. Now, even if a cyclo has a soul and does his thinking with a soul, or even if he doesn't have, mental action works between those two channels. So long as a cyclo is thinking logically, there is a constant current between those two nerves. Even asleep, there would be a current, a very slight one. Now up comes an alien. The cyclo knows his whole race and empire depends upon keeping his mathematics a secret. And the alien wants to know about cyclo mathematics. The cyclo instantly shuts off thinking about them. Or a surge occurs and then a shutoff. Pop! Blown fuse!"
McKendrick was quite interested. But he said,
That doesn't explain suicide."
"All right, look at this picture and look at this fuse. The silver capsule is very close to that bronze item that short-circuits pleasure and pain and action. Look at this fuse filament. When it parts, the ends drop down inside the capsule and you get a short circuit into the bronze item. The cyclo has an instant impulse to kill. If he can't right then, the short circuit between the silver and bronze items acts as an obsession to kill that doesn't let up. He has to kill something, and he winds up killing himself."
McKendrick thought it over and nodded.
"But that doesn't explain the females."
Johnny got that type of capsule and looked at it.
"It's another kind of fuse. Since mathematics is logical thought, it would cause a concentration of current to begin. They probably are taught not to teach females mathematics. It's part of their moral code. And the females are noted for being illogical. When they start to think in mathematical terms, or even try to, a current gets too heavy and they blow the fuse. They don't have a bronze object and they just go into a coma. Their wits won't connect anymore and they go out of communication with the nervous system."
Johnny paused.
"My explanation may not be complete, but I know these are just fuses and short circuits, and that's how they protected their empire."
"And why they're so crazy. I'm sure you have the explanation and that those things are what you say they are."
McKendrick turned the cyclo skull around on the table. It was a huge, massive, heavy thing. A complex mass of bone and joints.
"There's only one thing wrong."
Johnny was all revved up with having gotten that far. He listened.
"We're no closer to getting those things out of their heads than we were."
Johnny laid the pictures and the capsules down on the table beside the skull and walked quietly out of the room. It was definitely not a hopeful day. Part 23, Chapter 7. Johnny lanced northwest in the Mark 32 battle plane. The alert had come just over half an hour ago. Glen Cannon was in trouble. It was day 78, only 14 days before Turl had scheduled himself to fire. He had not begun his panel on the last discs Johnny had had. There had been a delay. And now this. Glen Cannon was under attack en route. The visitors, 400 miles above Earth, had increased. There were 18 of them now. Half-Captain Roger Dieter Snowell had come back, and with him he had brought four heavy war vessels. One of them at least, if not more, was a plane carrier. it was probably from this that the attack on Glen Cannon had been launched. Johnny had no communicator with him. He had simply been outside when the alert came. Stormalong and two other pilots had scrambled, and Johnny had simply grabbed an air mask and a plane. All the communication in the air right now was in Pali. Both Glen Cannon and Stormalong had communicators with them and were using them. Thus, Johnny could not tell what was happening. The sing-song of the Buddhists never showed excitement, even in combat. So their voice tones told him nothing. He was gaining altitude and widening his view screens. He had Stormalong and the other two ships just ahead of him. He had not yet picked up Glen Cannon. Johnny threw a scanner upward. Three of their visitors were way up there, not as clear in this bright daylight as they would be on scanners at night, due to daytime ultraviolet in the air. Was that the Volcor-class vessel? The other two with it were larger, more bulky. Yes, that was the Volcor-class. Diamond-shaped bridge. Half-Captain Rogerdieter Snaul himself. The three weren't coming down. Apparently it took a lot of solar accumulation to do that, and they tended to reserve themselves. The other two must be plane carriers. Yes, from one of them came a new launch. Six needle-like craft were coming down, like arrows. Clearly, using Cyclone, Johnny said,
"Six new Hornets from above!"
That would warn Stormalong. There was Glen Cannon, streaking along at about 100,000 feet, flat out, heading for the mine site. Where was his escort? He should have an escort. No sign of them. Four needles were shooting along behind Glen Cannon. Occasionally, a long-range flash of fire laced out from them. There went Stormalong. In tight formation, the three planes cut straight through the pursuing Tolneps. An explosion. A second gout of hot blue flame. And a third. There was only one Tolnep racing out of the smoke. Johnny turned up to intercept the six coming down. They grew larger and larger in his sights. He centered on the nose of the leader. His thumb hit the firing trip as he wildly swung sideways, sweeping his awesome firepower into the Tolnep's tight formation. His view screen flared out with the explosions ahead. A slight thump as a broken piece of a Tolnep plane touched his wing. Johnny flipped around as they went by him. He sighted in on the tail of the last ship. He hit the trip of the blast cannon. He was skidding so wildly from his turn that he missed. Four Tolneps left to go. He flashed ahead of them and spun about. He was almost head-on with the Tolnep, now leading. An instant before they would have collided. Johnny's shots stuffed the Tolnep's own fire up his cannon barrels. The ship exploded. Three Tolneps left. They looped and came on, firing in formation. The air about Johnny was slashed. The Mark 32 took a hit in the windscreen. Half of it went black. Johnny's guns were going. One Tolnep. Two Tolneps. The last one tried to make a run for it, shooting back into the heights. Johnny steadied his battle plane. He threw the firing sets onto flame and maximum range. He sent searching needles straight up. The Tolnep shattered into a ragged ball of fire. Where was Glen Cannon? There he was, racing down to the mine site, almost there. He had a Tolnep right on his tail. Stormalong and his other two ships were slashing down on the Tolnep. The guard opened the atmosphere armor curtain, and Glen Cannon flashed through. He was safe. A scythe of fire hit the Tolnep as Stormalong and the other two pilots let drive from extreme range. The guard got the atmosphere curtain on. The Tolnep hit it and slammed through. The air had not had time to reionize enough. The Tolnep ship exploded in a ball of flame in the scramble area, narrowly missing Glen Cannon's ship as it landed. Johnny and Stormalong scanned the skies for more enemy. There was none. Some smoke palls rose in the distance where enemy ships had disintegrated. The guard opened the atmosphere curtain. A firefighting crew was there now, spraying the burning wreckage of the Tolnep ship. Johnny, Stormalong, and the other two landed. Glenn Cannon was sitting in his seat still. His Buddhist communicator was trying to calm him. Glenn Cannon was crying. His hands were shaking. It was a reaction of total frustration.
I had orders to come through.
Glenn Cannon was repeating over and over. The communicator waved the others away and then came to them.
There are many things for the Academy of Pilots to do in America.
The Buddhist told Johnny and Stormalong.
They also have to maintain their air cover. There were no escort pilots, and we delayed coming for days. Then Glenn Cannon felt he could not delay any more. A Swiss pilot, a close friend of his, but a very new pilot, volunteered. The Tolneps hit us just after we crossed the coast in northern Africa. It was too far away for Cornwall or Luxembourg to help us. The Swiss fought them off. He shot down three, but he needed help, and Glenn Cannon had orders to keep going in such an event, and he kept going. He feels that if he had turned back to help the Swiss, they wouldn't have got him. The Swiss pilot was alone. He had no communicator, but he also told Glenn Cannon to keep going. The Tolneps shot the Swiss to pieces. When he ejected and tried to get down by backpack, they closed in and killed him in the air. Glenn Cannon wants to go up and shoot down those ships in orbit. They would murder him. Please, help.
They got Glenn Cannon calmed down. Stormalong said that he would call Sir Robert and get the vital communication line made more secure. Sir Robert was going over to move the Academy out of America and to the Cornwall mine site in a few days, but meanwhile, better arrangements should be made. The ferrying of innumerable planes and equipment to safe places was now all complete. The tribes were centralized. Stormalong also said he would take over the run. Glenn Cannon handed over the pouch of discs. Johnny looked at the packet. He hoped it was worth it.